I have several suttas that are very, I love them. I read them over and over and over and over and over. But there's a couple. I don't have time to talk about both of them, so I decided I had to pick one, and I'm going to tell you about this one that I love so much. It has to do with the Buddha, when the Buddha was first enlightened, and when he got enlightened, he's awake now. And he spent several days, you might know, walking around and thanking the tree that he sat under. Just take a moment. Think about a tree. Have you ever been that in love with a tree that you would spend a week walking around it, thanking it? But trees do that much for us. They definitely shade us, they help us. But just having this deep-seated gratitude for the tree's willingness to hold him while he went through all he went through, that's a level of gratitude I have never reached. But nonetheless, that's the level that the Buddha was in. And while he was sort of in this state, he thought to himself, this Dhamma that I have attained is deep, hard to see, hard to realize, peaceful and refined, beyond the scope of conjecture, subtle, to be experienced by the wise. This is the place he was at. We all know this. Let's don't think of it in terms of where you would be at in deep concentration. I mean, as an awakened being. Let's just think about how we feel at the end of a retreat. This place we've come to is deep. It is refined. It's beyond the scope of conjecture where we're at in that place, right at the end of a retreat. It's subtle and it's hard to see, hard to realize. That place right there, in that moment, he thought about. I think a thought arose in him to teach. I think this thought said, oh, like we do at the end of a retreat, oh, I should share this with someone. This place I'm at. But then he thought, this generation delights in attachment, is excited by attachment, enjoys attachment. For a generation delighting in attachment, excited by attachment, enjoying attachment, this and that conditionality and dependent arising, all of his Dhamma, it's hard to see. This state, too, is hard to see. The resolution of all fabrications, the relinquishment of all acquisitions, and the ending of craving, dispassion, cessation, unbinding. And if I were to teach the Dhamma, and if others would not understand me, that would be tiresome to me and troublesome for me. Right? So just think about it. I don't know anyone here, if you have been on a retreat, that moment when you think about going back home. Especially, I'm talking about a retreat on the land where you've been tucked away, all cozy. Everything is beautiful. And at the end of that retreat, you feel so expansive, full of love. You can love everybody, everything. And then that thought happens. damn it, I gotta go home. I gotta go back to work on Monday. That whole, it's like all of that is going to disrupt my peace. So you understand what Buddha was thinking. He's so subtle. And then the thought of having to talk to other people obsessed with attachment. I can remember the idea of trying to explain this to my family. These are black folks that don't have nothing to do with Dhamma. They don't understand it all. They already don't understand why I would go anywhere and not talk. That's already a game changer. So what he says is, enough now with teaching what is only difficult, enough now with teaching what only with difficulty I reached. This Dhamma is not easily realized by those overcome with aversion and passion. What is obtuse, subtle, deep, hard to see, going against the flow, those delighting in passion, cloaked in the mask of darkness, won't see. As the Buddha reflected on this, his mind inclined to dwell, to continue dwelling at ease, not to teach the Dhamma. So in that moment in time, there's no Dhamma that you and I would receive. In that moment in time, the Buddha was inclined to just relax and stay in the peace. It would be like you deciding, I think I just want to stay here at this retreat a little while longer. Not really going to go back to that job. And if I don't have to go back to that job, I might not go back to that job at all. So I want you to take a moment and close your eyes. This is the only way I can think of helping us begin to access something that's so hard to see. So close your eyes and think for a moment. I don't care how long you've been in the Dhamma. Think for a moment. What you were like before you began to practice. The level of reactivity. The level of, tightness, overwhelm. Just the level of difficulty you've had in life. So kind of fast forward a little bit here and think about what is it that you could say the Dhamma has brought to your life? What ease has come because of your practice? Maybe you can just, I can see things, I can be with the difficult more now than I used to. I'm not so reactive as I used to be. I still might be a little reactive, but I just don't get so out of control, or I can bring myself back easier. You know what it is that you were like before, what the Dhamma has done for you over the years. But you can see why the Buddha would be inclined not to share this. And at the same time, you might can have a degree of gratitude that he chose to share it. You might be able to sense just how grateful you are that he shared what we know, because what we know comes from what happened next in the story. But at this moment, the Buddha did not want to share this with us. All right, you can open your eyes. What happened next in this story is that a Brahmin who was in what we would call heaven, I guess, the heavenly realms, overheard the Buddhas lamenting about teaching. And he kind of freaks out at the idea that the Buddha would not tell what he had known. Because I want you to, there's something I learned in the teacher training. I didn't know this before, but the Buddha was not the first person to get enlightened. So we can't be mistaken about that. He wasn't the first person, the one and only person to awaken. That's not what the Buddha was. There were many people who had awakened, who were enlightened. What made the Buddha, is that he remembered what he did, and he could articulate that path. That's what makes him different. It's the articulation of the path. And there's a sutta where the Buddha is explaining this to a room full of monks. And I'm assuming there were some nuns in there too, but a room full of monastics. He's explaining the Dhamma. And one of the monastics, one of the monks in the room, I think what he did was, I think he just picked up a flower. Very subtle, just kind of a random thing. And one of the monks in the room started laughing. And the Buddha said something about, oh, I see Venerable so-and-so understands. But in this moment, there was an understanding that had happened. This is the sutta, so this is a Buddha story, spiritual story. There's an understanding that what had happened from this whole layer of people in the heavenly realms. And they yelled up to the people in the realm even higher than theirs, and they yelled up to the people even higher than theirs, and there's this whole line of kind of what you could say rejoicing that started happening, because in that moment, Buddha actually helped another being understand Dhamma. Just from his words, that he had, in effect, turned the wheel of Dhamma. And that's why we say that the Buddha's turning the wheel of Dhamma. He actually spoke in such a way that another person could hear the Dhamma and carry the Dhamma into their life. The reason why that's freedom is because we all can listen and read about the Dhamma and turn the wheel in our own lives. That you don't have to stumble upon it by yourself like Buddha did. That's what makes Buddha's capacity to share the Dhamma so important, is that he was able to tell how to awaken. So this Brahmin up in the heavenly realms comes down to the Buddha and says, please, you can't, hold on, hold it right there. You can't do that. You can't do that. There are people out there who just have a little bit of dust in their eyes. If you could, you could help them. You could speak to it and they could see. You could not leave the world in darkness. And so the Buddha kind of looked out over the world and realized this to be true. And once he, with compassion, looked out over the world, he could see the suffering that existed. He could see what it would mean if he did not tell people how to follow this path. But the path he was going to tell people is very, what did he call it? Difficult to see. It's very hard to see, subtle, obtruse. That's the word I was looking for. Obtruse, hard to see, going against the flow. It's hard to realize it's peaceful. This is hard to realize what it is that we're doing here. But the Buddha saw with compassion what it would mean if he left people to spend eons and eons and eons in suffering without an exit until they stumbled upon another exit. So instead, he began to teach. That's why he started teaching. Ananda wrote it down. Other people wrote it down. All of a sudden, we have all these Pali canons. We have all this. 2,600 years, monastics have been teaching and carrying. And here we are sitting in our little sangha in Victoria, everybody in their own little house, talking about the Dhamma. That capacity to do that. I mean, we were all kids and we played that little game where you told whispered in somebody's ear and whispered and whispered and whispered and whispered and whispered. By the time it gets back to you, it's nothing like what was said originally. But the Dhamma that we talk about here is the same Dhamma that Buddha talked about then, 2,600 years ago. So the Dhamma that we're talking about is something that becomes true in our felt sense. That's where the truth of it comes from. It doesn't come from the fact that somebody told you. It doesn't come from me telling you about Nibbana. I could tell you about Nibbana all day long. You could take the notes, write it down. Oh, this is what Nibbana is. But it wouldn't bring you any closer to freedom. But because you and I know that we have all felt moments of that, the truth of it isn't coming from me. It comes from your own experience as practitioners. That's where the truth of this comes from. I think that truth is the third noble truth. That's what I think it is. I think it comes from this wrapping around of the four truths. The first noble truth being there is suffering. The recognition that the doorway to awakening comes through suffering. And the second noble truth, beginning to see and understand the cause of suffering, recognizing there is a cause for suffering. And then the third truth is that there is a path that leads to the cessation of suffering. And the fourth noble truth is the path. So when I think about the third noble truth, I always had a problem that the third noble truth came as number three instead of as number, like somehow it should be the path should come before the three. So that you could say, oh, there's suffering and there's a cause for suffering, and here's the path that leads to the end of suffering, and then there's the end of suffering. That's the way I thought it should be. For a long time, I thought it should be that way. But then I begin to realize that the reason why the realization of the end of suffering comes before the path is that in some respects, in the kinds of minds we have, if we don't know that there is an end, we will not even step on the path. So in a way, the third noble truth is projecting the end of suffering to us. What the Buddha said is that now, practitioners, this is the noble truth of the cessation of dukkha, the remainderless fading and cessation. Renunciation, relinquishment, release, and the letting go of that very craving, the craving that causes suffering. I've come to the conclusion that I think there are three things we have to think about this. And these are the last, this is what I'm going to talk about, is these three things. What that means, that third truth. The first is, I think the third truth is pointing to a huge distinction between what is conditional and what is unconditional. We, as practitioners, are practicing to learn the difference between what is conditional and what is unconditional. We watch the breath because the breath is unconditional. I mean, it's conditioned on living, but it is not our ability to know that next breath is coming. It is the arising of sound. It's conditioned, but the arising of it is unconditional. We can't control most of what goes on around us. So as practitioners, when we sit and meditate, we're not just trying to get calm. We're trying to learn the difference between pure experience, bare experience as it is, and this kind of loaded experience that's loaded with all my thoughts about it. So sound is unconditional, but the sound of a bird is conditional. Breathing is unconditional, but my breathing is conditional. I believe that sensation is unconditional, but my knee pain, my back pain, that is conditional. And we are learning to distinguish between these two realms of these two ways of looking at experience. If I reference the world from the I, me and my thoughts, my this, my that, my, I live in the ordinary world and I suffer. If I learn to begin to spend more time in the unconditioned, whatever hearing is occurring, sensation is occurring, this is occurring, I learn to live in the unconditioned, I become suffering less because life becomes more of what it is. The second thing I think we learn that the third noble truth is pointing to, first it's pointing to there are two worlds, conditioned and unconditioned, and we have to learn to see those two. Second, it's pointing there are two releases. There is the release that comes from physical force, and there is mental release. We all know the release that comes from physical force. We can make something happen. We can make something stop. And we feel better if something stops that we don't like. And we feel better if we make something happen that we want. But we don't have the ability to always get rid of what we don't like and always make happen what we want. And because of that inability to control the results, we suffer. On the other hand, there is a way that we can learn the second type of release, which is what I think the Buddha was pointing to, and that is mental release. We don't always see this because we're so used to making things happen physically that we don't always see the freedom that comes with mental release. I think that's what the renunciation is. That's what the remainderless is. That is the release and the relinquishment that I think the third noble truth is pointing to. It's pointing to when the mind lets go of its entanglement with something. And no matter how we want to make our minds not think about that, we cannot do that. We cannot make that mental release happen. That comes when we actually just surrender and allow the moment to be. Whatever the mind is attached to, it releases on its own. And learning to experience the mind's own release, that I don't have to do anything to make that happen, it just happens, requires one major thing, and that is patience. To give the mind all the time it needs until it decides to release. Those of you with kids know what I'm talking about. No amount of wanting those kids to get those shoes tied is going to help them get them shoes tied quicker. No amount of wanting and showing and trying to help them learn how to use a potty is going to help them use a potty. It's just, it comes when it's there ready for it to come. And there's a degree of compassion and care that we have to have. It's the same compassion that I think the Buddha have experienced. It would be like the Buddha is saying, there's just a little dust here in your dust in your eyes. It's just a little awkward here. Let me just have some patience, some compassion to give space and time to this liberation. And the last area I think we practice with, we kind of teeter between these three areas, conditional and unconditional, and learning what that is, physical release versus mental release, and learning what that is. And the last kind of area that we kind of balance on is the learning about relative and absolute realities. What is relative cessation? What is absolute cessation? And we teeter in between these worlds. What I have learned in the practice is that the more I'm willing to practice between these areas, the more I'm willing to look for what is unconditional, even in the midst of conditional, the more I'm willing to see, is there any mental release that can occur in this moment, whether there's physical release that can occur or not. When I consider what is the distinction between relative cessation, I mean letting go, letting life be as it is, and my ultimate release and happiness, my ultimate nibbana possibility. That's the line I think I practice with in the Third Noble Truth. I think the way we do this the reason why I think the path is what guides us, because if you think about the path, it's really just three parts. It's the way we view the world, the wisdom we hold when we live the world, our actual conduct, and the third part is our meditative practice. At any given moment, we could begin to look at one of those three areas and see where suffering is arising. Oftentimes, the only reason why I'm suffering is because of my, the way I'm looking at the situation. If I shift my view a little, take the I out of it, often I begin to have more ease, less pain. Sometimes I can see that my view is correct. I don't have any I in it. I'm not taking it personal. But still, there is difficulty here. And all I can do is watch my conduct to make sure I don't do any further harm. Make sure my speech is as soft and as skillful as possible. And my ability, I have also noticed, I don't know about you, but sometimes if I don't practice enough, I can see that it gets harder and harder for the other two. And so having a regular ongoing practice, just so I can practice vacillating between the conditioned and the unconditioned, vacillating between what is physical release and what is mental release. And beginning to understand the difference between what is cessation on a relative level and what is cessation on an ultimate level. I really think that the gift that Buddha gave us is not Nibbana. If somebody gave Buddha Nibbana, he wouldn't be walking around the tree thanking it for a week. The reason why Buddha was walking around that tree and thanking it for a week is because the gift was the journey he took in order to obtain this awakening. And that gift he shared with the tree. That's why he's thanking the tree, because it's not easy to do what it is that he did. I mean, he said as much. It's hard to obtain. But anything, I mean, just think on a retreat that you've had the best retreat you ever went to at the end. It was probably the worst retreat when it started. And there's something about being with difficulty, staying with it, working through it, something about that release that feels so rewarding. The way Buddha talks about release is like this. You know, many of you may already know this, but anyway, he categorizes it in five ways. He says it's like being a slave who is held in bondage and told where to go and when to go, and they're not their own. They don't have their own choice to be, and then they are released from bondage. And the freedom, the way they feel when they find out that no one is in control of their lives anymore. That level of freedom is what Nibbana points to. Or he uses someone who's in prison and you're locked in prison. You can't get out. You're not free to come and go as you want, like we are used to. And then someone lets you out of jail. You're free to come and go as you want to. That freedom is what he points to as Nibbana. Someone who's very, very sick, seriously, gravely ill, thinks they're going to die. And then some medicine they take and it changes and the fever breaks and their health begins to come back and they feel more uplifted. That freedom, when they're finally free of that illness. Or the people who are weighted down in debt. When you're weighted in debt, you can't even think straight because the mind is so overwhelmed with how are you going to make it, and then the debt is released. And finally, you've got all your valuables and you're traveling home down some dangerous road, and then you see yourself free. That's, you finally get home with all your valuables and you weren't robbed. So what he was pointing to is the level of release that you feel when you have overcome the heaviness of dukkha. But we need to be clear. You got to feel the dukkha, meaning that you have to actually be in bondage in order to understand what it's like to not be in bondage. You have to know what it's like to be in prison, to be closed in, to know what it's like to not be. And you have to know what it, you have to feel sick. I've never been in bondage. I've never been in prison. So the examples I use, though, is the example of I've been very, very sick, and then know what it feels like when I'm not. I know what it feels like to be laden with debt and what it feels like to be free of it. And I know what it feels like to travel home when I'm scared to go through a neighborhood. So I know what that feels like. And that's what I begin to think about when I think about this freedom. I guess the point that I'm trying to say is, this last point I'm trying to make is, if you've figured out a way, so you're never in bondage, you don't go to prison, you don't have any debt, your health is good, you don't have to travel down any dangerous roads, in the common sense, you would think, oh, I had a great life. I had a good life. Never got in trouble. Don't have any debt. Everything was good for me. But you will never be able to experience Nibbana. In order to experience Nibbana, you have to know suffering firsthand and then see the release of that suffering. And when you see the release of it, then you know Nibbana. Both the, and it's not the physical release, something you made happen. It's when you see the mental release, the unconditioned ultimate reality that you didn't have anything to do with that. Something let go, something freed you, and you know you're free. And when you know that, yeah, you'd be walking around your house, thanking the house, thanking the trees. Who do I need to thank? Can I thank somebody? Somebody's got to be thanked here, because this is, that's what we feel at the end of a retreat. We just want to thank everybody, anybody. This is what I think he was pointing to. So this is what I'm hoping to leave you with Nibbana, is not the sense of I know what Nibbana is. Because you may know, you may have had moments of this release. Some of you may have had significant moments of release. And your Dhamma eye is completely open. The wisdom is there. But that is not like the end of it all, if there's any suffering. If there's any suffering, there's more practice to be done. And that's a gift, to be able to practice with it. Just want to leave with this one little quote here. Last little reading from Ian McCrory's book. It's really good. He's got some good poetry in here. A young goat herder saw the Buddha sitting under a tree. Enchanted by his serenity, he approached the Buddha and asked, "Are you a god?" "No," the Buddha replied, "I am not a god." "Are you then a man?" the goat herder asked. "No," replied the Buddha, "I am not a man." "Then what are you?" asked the boy. I am awake, said the Buddha. I am awake. Geez, to me, if somebody looks at you like that, just because you're awake, I think that is serious. That is worth investigating. So let's take a moment to just sit quietly here. We'll let these words kind of wander off. What a day. Are you a god? No, I am not a god. Are you then a man? No, I am not a man. Then what are you? I am awake.